Hello and welcome to In Ink We Trust, Tattoo and Art Culture in the San Fernando Valley, bringing you the latest who's making a mark on the tattoo scene. I'm your host, Anthony Sanchez. Today we're going to talk to Nathan Peterson from his namesake, Nathan's Tattoo and Piercings in Canoga Park. Nathan began piercing in 93 and he opened his shop in 2000. So thank you so much for coming by.
Great to be here, Anthony. I'm honored.
So what do you think about the weather this month in LA?
With LA, you never quite know what to expect. But growing up, I always had leaky roofs, so whenever the rain comes around, I always get a little bit nervous. Mm-hmm. But luckily, my roof doesn't leak,
kind of ingrained in you to kind of be like, uh-oh.
Sort of a fear, like a scramble when you see the clouds coming in. It's like, okay, do we have a tarp? Do we have some wet roof patch? But thankfully, no leaky roofs right now.
Yeah, we had a similar place in Baldwin Park. It was kind of, you know, a lot of people... They call that white flight, I think, that area. When I moved into Baldwin Park, where, you know, retired people kind of didn't repair the place, and then they rented it to us, and we had a patio that would leak, and me and my brothers would take turn mopping out the patio because yep. The water would just slowly get closer, closer, closer.
Yeah, that would suck. It was like the great floods coming in.
Yeah, and it'd always be like, can you repair the roof? And they're like, eh. Yeah. So I think you spent a little time between NorCal and SoCal. Do you have any favorite things between the two places?
Yeah, my wife is from Redding, California, so we go up there quite a bit. We manage a building up there, so it's good to get away from piercing once in a while, swing some hammers, get creative with just creating spaces and redoing apartments and commercial spaces. So it's good to get out of town. Love LA, third generation Angeleno, but it's good to not have traffic once in a while, to see some trees once in a while, to see, even though the LA River is coming up a little bit, it's still nice to see real rivers and nature. So
yeah, I forget that we have like basically that Pacific Northwest thing going up in the north. So
definitely. And beautiful place. I mean, smaller communities seem to be a little bit more enjoyable. And I think in LA, if you say hello to somebody on the street, they go, are you crazy? Or what do you want from me? So up in Redding, if you say hi to somebody, they say hi back and they're happy to chat with you and not be freaked out by you.
Yeah, same when my family's been here for a couple of generations too, since the Great Depression. And I've noticed the difference between, like, you know, it feels more New York here where you do bump into somebody, they're like, meh.
Yeah. It's sort of sad. I think it's getting that way. And I think some of it is some people move out here to make it big and they get disenfranchised and they bring some bitterness. So I think if you're a native Angeleno, you're typically maybe a little more comfortable and a little bit nicer to people. Where if you're an embittered transplant, you get a little bit more less tolerance.
Yeah, we could go on for days about that because we apparently agree on that. You said it the exact same way I would have said it to someone else.
Right on. I feel an affinity with you.
So. Then, did you, since you grew up in kind of the 90s-ish, did you happen to ever read the Anarchist Cookbook?
That was more in the 80s. I had a neighbor that was always just doing weird stuff. He always was like making his own weapons and doing weird stuff. And his dad was a Vietnam vet. And he just seemed like he was into that stuff. So we'd read it. But some of it was really weird. I think he was trying to get high off of banana peels. I think that was a big thing from the Anarchist Cookbook back in the day. But yeah, during the 80s, I remember he had a copy of it. It was a big deal. You'd have to go to some little clandestine bookstore with some guy wearing a bunch of military garb and then slide it under the table to you. And it was really just sort of a fun part of exploration and hunting, I think, in the 80s, finding books like that.
Yeah. I knew about it in the 90s because that's when I was a teenager, but I was a baby. I guess we're roughly the same age anyways. So why don't we talk a little bit about you had a life as a roadie, it looks like.
Well, when I was, what was I, probably about 15 years old, I dropped out of Granada Hills High School. And looking back, maybe I shouldn't have because Granada Hills High School is so well-renowned now. I mean, it's like going to Harvard or something. But at that time, it sort of sucked. And I just ended up leaving school one day and booking shows in my basement and just traveling with bands and got a job with a record label. My friend Paul Mache brought me in as his assistant at a Delicious Vinyl Records, and we did a little imprint label with bands like Naked Aggression and another band out of San Diego called Antioch Arrow, and roadied with Rage Against the Machine for a while, did some videography there, and that was a lot of fun to see the early 90s, mid-90s LA music scene. Really, really cool. And even in the piercing side of it, you had bands that represented that community. You had a band called Duchess de Sade, and that was very like piercing related, and yeah, it was a great time.
What was it like as far as being a roadie? Like, were you just moving around gear, or it sounds like you're doing video as well, so it's just a little...
Yeah, I think part of it, my friend Paul, who hired me at Delicious Vinyl, after a little while, he goes, a lot of people that get into music are just big music heads. And I love music. I listen to music all the time, and I love exploring and learning, but I think I like the culture more than just saying, oh, I want to have a picture taken with this person, or I want to be able to memorize every back of a Beatles album that ever came out. It was never much like that. It was just loving the culture of it. And when I got into it, my brother was a road manager for bands. He went to Europe with a band called Hana Garage, and they were playing with the Cramps out there. And I think part of it is he would just drag me along because I had a stronger back since I was young and I was free labor. So I would get like a hamburger or something out of breaking my back for a couple hours of dragging around gear. But when the band's playing, if you're working with gear, your job is pretty much done. Maybe you're protecting some of the pedals or if a cymbal's falling over. But those can be great vantage points to take photos from or do video from. So I'd always try and do that as well.
So it sounds like there was a lot of music when you were growing up then as well?
Not necessarily in the house. Maybe a little bit, but it was something that I started finding on my own. And I think part of it was just, once again, just music and culture coming together. If you're a kid and you're skateboarding, you know, punk rock was great to skateboard to. And it was neat just in my old neighborhood. A lot of the guys were into the bands in the golden era of hip hop. Eric B. and Rakim and EPMD and Public Enemy. And it was pretty neat. And as time went on, I was primarily in the punk rock genre. But when you look back at Public Enemy, I mean, they were about as punk as it got in the sense of ethos. And you could see similarities between those two genres of music, even though they might have musically sounded different.
Right. Do you remember the first time you heard hip hop then?
Probably, I think it was like the Breakin' movie or something. Mm. And I think probably 81 or 82. I was born in 74. So probably 7 or 8 years old, I imagine. Because, yeah, some of the older kids in the neighborhood were breakdancing. So, yes, I did have a pair of parachute pants. And I think that was probably 1983 or 82 or something.
Did you learn how to breakdance then?
Yeah, a little bit. But I was horrible at it. Yeah, my poor wife, I hate dancing and she loves it. But yeah, but you know, when you're 7, it's like that was the coolest thing if you could get your parachute pants and, you know, a pair of cool sneakers, you were on top of the world. But yeah, I was horrible at it.
What kind of music was around before that then for you?
Before I was 8?
Before hip hop and... Or even before you were 8. Whatever memory comes to mind. I'm not,
probably my mom just playing the guitar, and my dad was more into classical music. But I was the youngest of 4 brothers, so the older kids, you'd always hear what they were into. And some of my brothers have better taste of music than others.
Yeah, I know that me being the oldest, I guess I influenced a little bit of them, like my Bjork. First, they were like, turn that off. And, you know, now my baby brother's like, oh, I listen to Bjork when I think about you. So
it's sort of funny how the times change. It's nice to be validated with certain things when everybody's looking at you like you're a complete insane outsider. I remember early on in the piercing days, people were like, what's wrong with you? Are you a masochist? You know, and then I was actually going to hair school across the street from here at West Valley. And I got kicked out of there because I had piercings and I'd dye my hair different colors. That was probably 1990, 91, and they had a rule, no party colors in your hair. So they pulled me out of class, and they wanted me to grow my hair out so they could practice like finger waves in my hair. And so, yeah, just sort of ruined my time there, and I ended up splitting. But now you go there, and everybody's hair is dyed, everybody's pierced. And so it's sort of interesting how a generation can change the outlook.
Right. So what was L.A. like in the 90s for you?
I think for me, it was just exploration. I have a friend, Brian Smith, who we just saw at the Bauhaus show, and it's neat. He's still working with music, and he played in a band in my basement, and Peter Murphy from Bauhaus, one of his road crew, my buddy Oren, you know, he helped me build our first stage when we were doing shows in my basement. And Brian Smith used to say, Nathan, nothing is sacred to you. And I'd have to say, over time, I've sort of brought in my passions a little bit. But I think in the 90s, for me, it was just very much about exploration, whether it's musically or how does a body connect to the mind or why are we here? You know, all the great questions of philosophy. What are we doing here? What is our purpose? So I think in the 90s, for me, it was just relentlessly, fearlessly seeking those things.
So you started piercing in the 90s, and it somehow it was connected to you being a roadie. So explain a little bit about that.
I think when my first introduction to body piercings, besides nostrils and such, and earlobes, was, I think it was about 1990, 89, when I was working with Hana Garage when my brother bring me to shows, and I saw that they had piercings. And it just intrigued me. And as a punk kid, I was like, this is awesome. You know, this is phenomenal. So I started just trying to figure things out at that point in time and trying to learn more about it. And that was the introduction.
At that time, what kind of piercings were pretty normal prior to that, I guess?
I think at that time, a lot of the piercing community essentially came out of West Hollywood with a gauntlet. In the modern professional manner, as we know it, I know people could debate and pull up things from other decades, but the industry as we see it now came out of the gauntlet. And it was neat being around in that time, being in a small scene and having the piercing culture cross over with the music culture. And since it came out of the gay community, there's a lot of more maybe kink-related piercings, like nipple piercings, genital piercings. The curved barbell was initially called the PA bar, the Prince Albert bar, because that was its original application. So it was just a really fun time, I think, with a lot of creativity. People didn't quite know the boundaries. There's still a lot of exploration of what would work, what wouldn't. And there's just a ton of creativity. I think when anything's around for a while, people start writing more rules on it. So that was a time when there weren't as many rules, where people were getting hyper creative.
Are you hearing about any rules nowadays about piercing?
You know what? It's not as much. I guess, yeah, I can clarify that. Some of it is I believe some people have stretched ears just because they like it. It's beautiful. I mean, it goes back through time immemorial. It's creative. I think it's a great look. And some people do it just because they go, hey, here's what I want to do. But sometimes I get kids, or even adults for that matter, coming into the shop that it's like a one-upmanship, and it's what I hated about the jock culture when I was a kid, where it was like, oh, I can bench press 200 pounds, I can bench press 210, oh, I can bench press 220. It's like, who cares? Just bench press what you feel comfortable and what makes you happy. So with piercings, you get people going, oh, what size are your ears? Oh, 3/4? Wow, mine are an inch, you know, and they'll like look down on you because of that. So I guess that's an area where it's not as reflective on yourself, but putting yourself in a group of people and making comparisons amongst that of how many piercings do you have? Oh, I have 5 more piercings than you do, or whatever the case may be, where it should just be, hey, do your piercings make you happy? Do you find enjoyment of them instead of making you feel better than another person? Does it just make you feel more complete as you?
I think there was also a time like people, or maybe, you know, some of the people that I saw getting them, like just as a rebellion, or, you know, it kind of, as it becomes mainstream, it's harder for people to kind of decide where they stand on it. to get a piercing?
Yeah. I think there is the, in that time too, part of the cool thing about it was such a cool subset of society where if you had piercings, it was almost like a secret code, almost like back in the gay community before the internet, where people would wear handkerchiefs with different colors on different sides to identify themselves. I don't know. Are you familiar with that? The hanky code?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, key fobs and earrings and things like that. So there was sort of a certain coolness of it. If you had something, you ran across somebody else, you very much felt like a kindred spirit with them and a commonality.
Right. I guess I should explain quickly. There was a hanky code for gay men in the bars. To figure out what kinks you were into. It was mostly even the leather bars, but I don't know exactly because that was before me. And, you know, right side would be active, left side would be passive. So if you were into being, for example, top or bottom or, you know, you doing this to this, like this, yeah, that whole.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It got to almost a point of ridiculousness before it fell out of favor. I remember going to the Pleasure Chest and on Santa Monica at one point, and they had like 150 codes. It's like, man, I gotta like sit home. You're like a postman memorizing zip codes to figure out what people are into. It's like, oh, if you're red with a stripe of this, you're into, you know, having lollipops and, you know, hanging out and drinking a Sprite while you're, you know, hanging out with somebody. So yeah, it got really, really expanded beyond a reasonable manner. But I think like black was more into S&M. I think left was the dominant side and right was the submissive side. So what was interesting is periodically, not as much, but we get people coming into the piercing shop saying, oh, which side's a gay side to get pierced? And I tell them both sides, you know, are you a top or are you a bottom? So that's the relevance of it. And I think people in the 80s and 90s thought the right side was a gay side because being submissive, people associated more of a submissive gay person with being gay. They didn't look at the gnarly biker and think that he may be gay. So they sort of got a pass because they had more macho-ness associated with them. So when they saw like they're sort of more flamboyant hairdresser with the right ear pierced because they were submissive, they automatically thought right was quote unquote the gay side to get pierced.
Yeah, that was a thing at the time too. Like which side did you have a little earring on? I mean, and all that kind of disappeared once Grindr and Adam for Adam and Scruff came around.
Yeah, I think basically just people just started doing both ears. They're like, you know, I think ear stretching probably played a little bit of role in that, you know, just symmetry. I think symmetry is a neat thing. I lean a little bit more towards symmetry.
Yeah, I mean, every now and then I see a guy with just has one nipple pierced, and I'm like, why not just do both of them? And yeah, I do see and hear people getting piercings removed more now, though. So maybe it's going the other way, where they had their ear stretched and then they get it surgically. I don't know if you're.
Yeah, we run into a little bit of that, and I think some of it is people that stretch too fast and built up a lot of scar tissue. If they decide not to wear their jewelry, it doesn't close up nicely, and there's a lot of scar tissue that just looks sort of nasty, and it's not as clean of a hole. So you see people getting that sewn up more. And I think people just go through, maybe if they initially got it, maybe for the wrong reason, maybe they got it to fit in or under duress of a boyfriend or girlfriend, whatever it may be, then maybe that relationship ends and they pull piercings out. I've seen that when relationships end or start, I've seen some people come in more often, either to get things removed or things put in.
One thing I like about the septum piercing is like you can hide it. I noticed like, you know, if you had to go to a job interview, you could just kind of whoop.
Yeah.
So there's some of that too, right?
Yeah. I think that's a neat thing. And I think too, some people as they get older, they don't want as much attention. You sort of settle into life and your routines and your social circles and your just a little more comfortable and you don't want as much attention, where maybe when you're younger, you're looking to expand your network of friends and your sense of community. So maybe it's more of like a peacock thing of spreading the feathers to attract more people to you. But I think there is a validity in different stages of life of just saying, hey, let me sit back and just be a wallflower a little more and contemplate life and contemplate direction and past and present and future.
So what was your first piercing?
My first piercing was just earlobes as a kid. And then beyond the earlobes, it was my nipple. And then a tongue piercing and frenum and an ampulang. And yeah, I did a lot of my piercings. What was sort of interesting is in that time of the early 90s, there wasn't really much of an underage crowd wanting to get it done. It was more passed around maybe the adult scene, maybe the bar scene. So you didn't really get kids under 18 getting pierced. But being that my brother would bring me to shows and I was seeing all this stuff and understanding it, they didn't cart as much. It was really only a couple shops in L.A. There was there's a Gauntlet on Santa Monica, and then there was Crystal Cross working at Red Devil on, I think that was like La Brea. And I had my ampling done by her when I was 17, had my nipple pierced at the Gauntlet when I was like 16. And maybe I just looked a little older, but I don't think they had as much problem of kids wanting to get piercings done. So it's funny. I remember going back to the Gauntlet when I was like 17 and 3/4, or, you know, in 10 months, I was almost 18. And then they carded me at that point. They wouldn't pierce me. It's like, well, you already did these other ones. You already did my tragus and my nipple and, you know, such. So that was sort of funny.
It was beyond that point.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. But at that point, the Gauntlet put out a great magazine, which I believe helped shape the piercing community for what it is now, which was PFIQ, Piercing Fans International, quarterly. And they had a section called Pierce with a Pro, because the Gauntlet realized, hey, we're in West Hollywood. The whole world can't come to us to get piercings done. So when they released their magazine, they would outline different piercing methods. It was almost like a little how to do this piercing. So the Gauntlet sold supplies, Pleasure Chest sold supplies. So, you know, I'd read a lot of the PFIQs. I'd go to the Gauntlet when I was there. I would, because I was a broke kid, I would get apprentice piercings, and I would hear them talking the apprentice through all the steps, and I would be trying to watch and learn and understand. And that was sort of the foundation of things.
In that time, you would rely on these kind of textbooks or kind of how to's. I know that now when I was looking at the Gauntlet, there was one person who came out of there that she made the piercing Bible.
Yeah.
You know her.
Yeah. Elaine Angel, or she used to go by Elaine Binney. And,
so were, like you said, that was how you guys would learn how to do different piercings.
Yeah, the piercing Bible is a newer book. By that, I don't know what it is now, maybe a dozen years or something since she wrote that. But PFIQ was a big one. Fakir Musafar, who was a big influence on the piercing industry, he did a magazine called Body Play. There was another one out of England. I'm trying to remember what that was. But the one from Europe or England dealt more with almost like music culture too. Is pretty neat, and just fashion in a sense, where Body Play and PFIQ was a little more, it was more focused on piercing.
And with the kink world, do you feel like there was a distinction, like adult industry people getting more of a certain kind, or could you even tell?
Or clarify your question
a
little.
Kink, like, let's say nipple piercing. Mm-hmm. Some people would just get it because it looks cool, but some people, obviously, if you're dealing with West Hollywood Pleasure Chest, mm-hmm. in case people don't, it's a adult toy store, yep. primarily in West Hollywood, still there across from the gay theater. The last gay, it used to be called Tomcat? I don't know.
Yep.
So it's kind of an era of, you know, you do this for a kinky reason.
Yeah, I think back then people did it more as a personal thing. And part of that probably was a little bit of society's judgment, where you had to be pretty brave to get more facial piercings and things like that. You would constantly get people commenting or people pulling their children away from you, things like that. So with that being the case, a lot of it was a little more personal, even though there were outward things that could connect you to others. I think there was a kink aspect where there was more genitals, more nipples, and it was more just for your personal life, not for your outside life.
And I guess to kind of, you know, connect that to now, do you see the same amount of, you know, genital piercings?
Maybe that's a tough thing to quantify because okay. You have different factors where we're in the West Valley. So being in the West Valley, we're dealing with maybe not the same clientele as, say, West Hollywood or Hollywood. Even though I've always been pretty connected to the gay community, you know, I had a lot of friends that came out when I was in high school, and that made me have a better understanding and a better love and care for people. But with that, the West Valley isn't really known for a really big gay community. So it's hard to say exactly what's going on there. And I think I do have quite a few gay male clients, and they enjoy the services I have to offer. But I have a friend, Ian, who is gay, and he gets a lot more interest than I do because a lot of the gay men want a gay man to pierce them. So, which is cool. And so he's, you know, he books appointments at my shop once in a while for work. So some of it, there's a lot of factors where it's hard to quantify exactly what's going on.
Okay. So I think what I'm hearing is maybe you don't get as many penis piercings personally because they go to Ian.
Yeah. There may be a certain amount of that in just regions. But no, I think we definitely do our fair share. And I think some of that's just our reputation of our knowledge, our cleanliness, right. Our bedside manner. So we do quite a bit. But I think the reality maybe is geographically, there's not a giant pool around us to pull from.
I see. Or just stabbing.
Yeah.
It'd also be hard to tell because if somebody already has one, how are you going to know unless you're...
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have any warnings for people that might try to do piercings at home? Because I'm sure people still do. They used to do like baby, like you light a warm up a pin.
Sewing needle.
Yeah, and you know, put a potato behind.
Yeah, I think it's sort of tricky because for me, when I got into this, a lot of it was just figuring it out. I had a friend's mom, Nurse Debbie, who would help sterilize things. She would help, you know, get me gloves, get me disinfection things, get me needles, and, you know, from the medical field. So when I did it, there's two shops in LA and there was no piercing shops in the Valley. So there weren't too many ways to learn how to do it. So I sort of had to do it by figuring things out, by doing research, by experimentation. But now there's a lot of great piercers out there. What I would say is if somebody's thinking about doing it on their own, a lot of times they're wanting to do it on their own either to save a buck. And if they're trying to save a buck, I think it's better to look around at some reputable shops, see if they have an apprentice that will do it at a reduced rate. Or if they're wanting to do it on their own because they want to do it as a profession, I think the better thing is to just look for shops that they like and talk to them and see if they're looking for an apprentice. Ask that shop or that piercer what they can do to push forward to make themselves more desirable as an apprentice. Because a lot of times when people are piercing on their own and they come in and want an apprentice, that's a red flag to us. It shows a certain amount of recklessness, and then it shows trouble in training as well, because now we're going to have to untrain all these bad habits that they taught themselves. So I think it's better to work with a professional shop.
Is there kind of an unsaid rule about how long you need to train before you can take on an apprentice? Because that is like a red flag probably.
You mean how long somebody needs to be a piercer to apprentice?
Yeah, a piercer, like 5 years. And then, you know, because in academia, there's all these rules that have been there for hundreds of maybe thousands of years.
Yeah. I think rules are good sometimes, but you need to look at why they were put there in the first place. there's a joke within the tattoo community that goes, great, you've been tattooing for 25 years and you still suck. You know, great, you've been piercing for 15 years and you still can't do something properly. So time doesn't always equate to quality. So even within my shop, if a piercer's been with us, say, for 3 years and we get a new apprentice, I'm not just going to say to that three-year piercer, hey, train this person up. But I may say, hey, these are things that you're good at after 3 years that you have a great understanding of. Maybe it's somebody that just has a great bedside manner or somebody that just understands technical aspects great. And I go, hey, train this apprentice in these areas. And then I can look over that piercer that's training the apprentice and teach them little nuances of teaching and how different people learn, because everybody learns differently. So that allows for growth for that three-year piercer. So maybe when they're in 5 or 6 years, they may be able to take on an apprentice on their own. But some people are just horrible teachers.
That's true. That's true.
Even teachers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I met them. We talked about them earlier. Not here, though. So is there like a general, not to give away trade secrets, like what you like to work with an apprentice? You're looking for a personality, or, you know, if they can't pierce an ear without causing an infection, you're kind of like, hey, man, look for something else.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I'd say different piercers have strengths and weaknesses. I think the first thing is being passionate. If you don't have passion, you aren't going to stick around in something, no matter what your opportunities may be. So passion is big. Beyond passion, I would say dedication. Somebody may be passionate about something, but may not know how to wake up in the morning and put their clothes on and show up. So dedication, I would say loving people. What we do is very people oriented. If you don't like people and you aren't patient and you can't love all sorts of people, we may have a 75-year-old lady come in that's having a hard time putting her earrings in. The next we have, you know, somebody who may have bad command of our language. Then we may have somebody who's ultra wealthy and maybe feeling entitled come in. And then we may have somebody who's like borderline homeless coming in that wants to get something done. So if you can't love all sorts of people, if you can't follow the golden rule of love your neighbor as yourself, then for us at our shop, it's a hard fit. So you really need to care about people. And I would say that those are key elements. Obviously, when you get deeper in with people, what are their understanding of mechanics? Sometimes if people have like a construction background, or they're a hobbyist that likes to sew a lot, if they do a lot of like fine-tuned crafty type things, that can help with a tactile sense of understanding.
I just thought my train of thought. Are there any kind of rock stars in piercing?
It's getting ridiculous. I mean,
how do you become a rock star in piercing? That would be more, you know. Go ahead.
Well, some
people. I guess I
should
walk away now. I'll be back.
some people just, you know, truly may be talented, but they just want to convince the rest of the world that they're the greatest thing ever. And I think that just comes from the need of people's attention to affirm who you are in the world. So they may convince people how great they are. Then there's other people, you know, just like rock stars, you may have a band that sucks, but the lead singer walks around like they're the greatest thing on earth. And it's like, bro, I just saw your show. You sucked. You know, three people showed up and it was horrible. So, but they'll still have that rock star attitude. So you get that whole gamut in the piercing industry, which I believe that any craft, any trade should come from a place of just passion and humility and just loving what you do and doing it because you love it, and let the rest of society determine what your place is in that realm. And I don't think you should push for any sort of greatness in whatever you do in the sense of perceive greatness. I think you should pursue greatness in the sense of caring for your craft and pushing yourself as far as you can go. But yeah, it's getting a little bit ridiculous. And I think a lot of piercing came out of transition into the punk rock scene. And maybe some of that was a punk scene mixing with a gay scene in the 80s and into the 90s. But then the punk scene very much took the torch, and you had a lot of punk rock piercers from the 90s. And I think punk rock a lot of times has a little more of a DIY humble aspect, but now you're getting these piercers that are just like, hey, I want to make a lot of money so I can buy a lot of like Gucci and stuff. And it's just really, really bizarre to me.
I mean, if I was going to wax poetic on that, it's also a valley kind of, we're in a Kardashian world where it is about celebrity. So people are going to want to be pierced or tattooed by a celebrity because they want to feel like a celebrity. That piercer or that tattoo artist is like a Gucci bag to them. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that's one of the hard things. As a businessman, what I should do is probably plaster multiple pictures of every celebrity client we get in our piercing and our tattoo side. And we've had our a good, probably more than our fair share over time.
Which you've already shared a little bit, right? Verbally, you've shared it, but it's just not, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of shops, they'll just totally blow it up all over the place. And that's great. You know, we've met some celebrities that are really, really nice and really cool and really down to earth and just great, fun people. But at the same time, just because somebody's a celebrity doesn't mean that they have a better understanding of our industry. We're honored that they're coming to us, and we believe they're coming to us because we offer a great service. But at the same time, like, I remember looking at the Playboy in the 90s where Drew Barrymore was in it, and she had tattoos, and her tattoos were horrible. Hmm. You know, they weren't that great.
I've got to go back, maybe not like a Playboy, but
yeah. But her tattoos at that time weren't that great. But people could go, hey, Drew, I tattooed Drew Barrymore. And it's like, yeah, you did a mediocre tattoo on her. And the ridiculous thing is you may get a lot of clients because of that.
That's a shame, because she probably could have afforded a really good, and there was plenty of good artists here in LA at that time.
Yeah, and that's the worst thing when you see these like sports stars and music stars that have like the crappiest tattoos. And it's like, man, you got the resources. You probably have a personal assistant that could spend a couple hours on doing some homework and figuring things out. But you see these people with horrible, horrible piercing and tattoos, and it's like, what's the deal? And say if somebody that has a lot of clout or social media influence goes to somebody crappy, and that crappy person pumps themselves up, they could gain a lot of business from it, but that's not because they're any good. And it's not because the celebrities have a better understanding of who is good and who isn't.
So as a shop owner, because we talk a lot about piercings, but you also run a shop with tattoo artists, are you picking those people? Because it sounds like that's something you have to look for if you're going to have somebody in your shop, a good piercer, a good tattoo artist.
With the piercing department I'm a bit more involved in the tattoo side, we have 7 artists. And just an issue of just having a lot of people to manage, it became pretty cumbersome. So Marco Antonio, I believe he was on here before, the art of Marco Antonio, to give him a little boost on here,
right,
on all the social media platforms. But he manages a tattoo site, and he does a better job at it than I ever would. With me not being a tattoo artist, he does have a deeper understanding of the arts and the needs. And I love to death our whole crew, and they're all great artists. But artists, whether you're a piercer, whether you're a painter, whether you're a tattoo artist, artists think a little bit different than society, than the mainstream society, which is brilliant. I believe they're able to see the future a little bit through their artistic outlook on things. But artists are trickier to manage than if I was like running a call center or something. I feel like I could probably manage 50 people. But managing 12 artists is like managing probably 100 people in a call center. So having Marco do that, I believe it just makes everything run smoother. I think it makes for a happier, healthier shop, divvying up the responsibilities.
I mean, in the year or so almost that I'm doing this now, I'm meeting these artists as well. How do you deal with the frustration of, you know, some are more professional than others. Some are, you know, great at getting back to you. Some are like, you know, just disappear off the face of the earth.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. Some of it is something that I think corporate America has started to realize in the last 15 years is play to people's strengths. I think before that, corporate America would say, I hired you for this job. This is our expectations. I want you to knock it out of the park in every single category. Where I think how we run things is looking at people's strengths. If somebody shows up a little late, hey, maybe that person, instead of saying, hey, you need to show up 15 minutes early, maybe to say, hey, you showed up a little late. Why don't you stay a little late? So what they're like is just your last batter that's just going to clean up, you know, like in baseball, they're just, okay, you're the last one at bat, clean it up. You know, so they may take the last client. So you can look at things to work well. You can take an unfortunate situation or take a lemon and turn it into lemonade by just looking at it overall. I think sometimes you get shop owners that want things, everything done a certain way. They're sort of control freaks with it, where I think if you loosen up, you can find benefits in what some people may look at as a detriment.
What was one of the challenges of opening a shop?
I'm glad that we opened up here in 2000. Before this, I worked in Huntington Beach from 93 to 98. At the Sunline Electric Chair, that's not there anymore, is sort of a punky clothing alternative store that did piercings. And I co-owned a shop on Ventura Boulevard for a couple of years. And I think co-owning a shop helped a bit because it helped ease me into it. It helped me build up some of my inventory, some of the materials. And I think when you get into business, part of it is I tell people there's a certain amount of insanity. You know, there's a certain amount of just going all in and just a certain amount of fearlessness and saying, okay, I'm going to throw everything I have at this. And if it doesn't work, I could end up, you know, borderline in the gutter, you know, when you throw everything at it. So there's a certain amount of insanity with it. But for us, it ended up working out. I think we came in at a good time. I think in 2000, I didn't have any heavy financial backing. So we've been able to make the shop a little bit more beautiful over time. Shout out to my wife who does interior design. She's made it the most beautiful it's ever been in the current era. Yeah,
full disclosure, I just found out today she was also in my Mission College class. So,
yep.
But we didn't conspire.
Yep, that's so cool. One of the neat things is within certain cultures and community, just how small the valley can be, 2 million people, and we run into weird little connections and crossways like that. But with it, when we opened up, I remember it was a Roundup here, I think, that did a little article on us years ago when we opened, and they said our display case looked like a snake cage or something like that. And part of it was just pulling from wherever you could, just doing the best you could, pulling all your favors that you could, and just trying to get things going. And the first year was tough. I didn't really go out much because I couldn't afford to. I was just putting everything back into the business and just trying to improve it. When clients weren't there, you know, it's likely I'd have a paintbrush out trying to fix up the paint or improve on certain parts of the shop. So it was a very grassroots, natural progression for us over the years.
So when you were going back to Huntington Beach, was there a surfer culture there, or was it punk rock by then?
It was punk rock, and it was, at least where we were, a sort of a mecca. You know, Sunline Surfboards changed into Sunline Electric Chair. They originally made surfboards in the 70s, and they started getting more into culture with Mike Roach. He was a local punk rock guy. He helped usher that in Orange County. So they did really well. And I think over time, Hot Topic and the internet sort of beat them up, and they dealt more with stuff made in America by smaller artists and smaller labels. And I think with fast fashion, that sort of makes that hard for those companies to exist. So they eventually ended up closing down, but they were sort of a punk rock mecca. You know, there's different bands. Couple of the gals from the band F Minus were there. They were one of the first 7-inch on Hellcat Records, and you had a lot of people coming through that were punk rock. And part of the sad thing is, in that era behind the Orange Curtain, there was still a lot of like skinheads and racists down there. I'd remember going to lunch and like almost getting in fights with Nazi skinheads. And
I don't think I've ever heard it called the Orange Curtain, but
Yeah.
I grew up closer to Whittier, and my grandma lived in La Habra. My half sister lived in Fullerton, so we kind of lived on the border of that. But me and my brother, since my brother's dressed more cholo, if we went like Brea, I think, on the other side of Beach, or what, I forget which street is closer to La Brea there. Yeah, if we were, you know, riding through there, cop would come through and be like, whoop, he's like, where are you guys headed? What are you guys up to? All right, we'll just head back to Covina. I don't want to see you guys coming back through here again. So.
Yep, that's what happens when you crack open the orange curtain.
But
for some reason, they're all right with a lot of Sieg Heiling Nazi skinhead, Nazi lowriders. But thankfully, that's not as common down there anymore.
But unfortunately, in the rest of America, it is.
I guess it may not be as apparent, but... You know, I think this is a whole other conversation, but yeah, I'm definitely not happy with where the world's at right now. But when we were kids, it was a bit gnarlier. I mean, in a physical sense, I mean, you could literally be on your lunch break, like getting in a fight.
Right.
You know, and there is different ways that racism can present itself and be instituted. But I am glad that there's not as much of that. I remember even growing up in Canoga Park, you know, we used to have a ton of gangs here, you know, and I remember just like walking down to the market and like my buddy getting like punched in his face because he wasn't a cholo, you know, and, you know, like cholos would just jump people and there's just tons of gangs. So I'm at least glad that people don't need to physically fight as much as they used to in L.A. I mean, L.A. was gnarly in the 80s and 90s.
Right. Did you hear from any of the, I don't think the skinheads maybe had a conversation with you, obviously, but that kind of, you know, you're betraying your white race by hanging out with people of color or.
Yeah. Some of that was pretty weird, but I think a good thing is I've always had a good amount of loyal friends. So it was very rare I'd just be on my own and get like cornered, you know. Okay. Usually it's like if you're in a group of people, it's not as big of a deal. And usually my group would be bigger than their group. So usually when somebody's outnumbered, the mouth stops moving quite a bit.
That's a whole other thing that we don't want to get into. I don't mind if we get into it, but yeah. I might get really upset.
Well, maybe we'll do a part two show. We'll do an LA, maybe an LA culture series is in the future for you.
Yeah. So what's the challenges of having so many more shops opening that are also tattoo and piercing? Because when you started, how many shops were around?
There's probably maybe... When we opened, there's maybe six or seven in the valley. I mean, there's World Famous Tattoo Emporium in Van Nuys. There was Graffiti Palace in North Hollywood. There was Think Ink. There was probably a couple more. I think there's about seven shops. So there's quite a bit more now. But our mantra has always been, we don't really care what other people are doing. Let's just focus on running our game, running it strong. Let's just care about and love each person that comes through the door, care for them the best that we can. No matter where they are in life, find a way to meet them and just enjoy the experience together with them. So whatever other shops are doing is sort of irrelevant to us, whether they're open up next door or I don't know, there's probably 50 shops in the valley now, but as long as we're doing things well, we're in a good position.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about the other people at your shop?
Yeah, we have an awesome crew, Marco Antonio, who manages the tattoo side. He's been tattooing for over a decade. And super talented artists. All of our artists are talented, and we have it's pretty neat because we're starting to tap into the younger generation. I think a lot of shops, you start getting old together, and it's almost like I'm not a Freemason anymore, but I joined the Freemasons, I don't know what it was, 15 years ago. And you walk in and it's like God's waiting room, you know, all these guys are like 70, 80 years old and they never thought to bring in a younger generation.
They have a lot of really specific rules about how they can add people though, don't they? Maybe not anymore.
It's a lot looser, I think, than one would think. And there are some young people getting into it now. But with that, it made me realize, like, hey, we're all getting older. If we just sit there and get older together, we have something to offer as elder statesmen as our crew. Some of us are getting into our 40s and hitting 50. There's a certain wisdom and a history and an understanding of the industry over time. But at the same time, you need to bring in fresh blood. So Marco's apprentice at Trina, she's killing it. We have a guy, Sean Gallagher, who both of them are in their mid to younger 20s. And it's neat getting that fresh blood in there. It's neat getting that kind of excitement and that kind of just passion fresh out of the gate and just seeing how they're seeing the industry from their generation, because things change. We're honored to have Javier and Todd at the shop too. They've been with us for, you know, over a dozen years, and just have a great crew there. And we try and diversify the crew, so when somebody comes in, everybody can find an artist that will meet their needs.
So are there any events and promotions coming up? I know you guys just had that Tim Burton thing. So anything else planned?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. One of our guys, Big Ray Inc., Ray, one of our guys, Ray, he's doing a great job with doing the shows. He was working on that with all the tattoo artists. We're probably going to plan something for the spring. It just takes a lot of work to do it right. You don't want to just schlep something together. Our last Tim Burton show was really, really awesome. Antonio Palaya got involved with that, and he did a great job helping us curate the show and put it together. So we're in talks right now doing something else.
Cool. Well, Nathan, I want to thank you for coming by the show today. Remind us where we can find you.
Perfect. We're at nathanstattoos.com. We're at 7222 Topanga Canyon. I'm an old-fashioned guy, so if you'd like to give a call, 818-49, or no, that's my cell phone. I probably shouldn't give that out.
Uh-oh.
818-340-5969. So, yeah, we'd love to have anybody swing by anytime and come and hang out.
Right, we have Instagram, Nathan's Tattoo and Piercings, but we're going to have all that in kpcradio.com as well. So again, Nathan Peterson from Nathan's Tattoo and Piercings. Thanks again. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Anthony Sanchez.